point to a sale, rebounding immediately. If instead of rebounding it was made to circulate, you said it constituted memory. Well, I was puzzled to know how that idea was related to the other idea of memory.
In the ordinary everyday use of the word?
Yes, in the earlier one, when you talked about memory, I asked, what about things such as technical skills and things learned for a trade, a craft, or something like that? They, to me, were memories at that time. You showed me how they weren't to be regarded as memories. But then in the case of the cell, when the stimulus is made to circulate, you said that was constituted memory.
All these ideas about death and memory and consciousness are related together very closely. Suppose we take the glyph M. It means substance. As we said before, you utter it with the mouth closed. And you feel full when you say mmm. Very often people say mmm instead of yes to a question. Do you think there's something in that? And they say mmm. If they're not sure, they put the tongue in the position where N is made, N. And keep the lips closed and say mmm. It's then NM. Now, this MNEME is the Greek for memory. We talk about mnemonics, memory aids. M is the same as substance. If we like to think of it as a waveform going along and then cut a piece off and say, let's write that, that's M, as substantial. If we do M like this and then draw an ellipse around it, that's the human mouth with Cupid's bow attached, if you like. M is substance and N is half of M. Now, substance is substantia, standing underneath. So we have to find out what underneath means. When we talk about the earth, and there is a man standing on the earth, he calls it underneath when he points to the centre of the earth. So, sub to him means towards the centre of the earth. Another man in Australia here says the same thing. So that down to both those men means the same place, centre of the earth. So when we're talking about substance, we're talking about that which is underneath in the sense of that which is central. Now we said before, when the spirit wanders about in this higgledy-piggledy manner, if we consider it substantially, we can call it mazy. But if we consider it without substance, we call it hazy. That's the behaviour of warm air in the sun, in the summer. Sometimes you'll see the landscape dithering like that, and we say it's hazy weather. The movement of the air does that. Now, unless that haze turns round and makes for itself a sphere, there is no substance, using our definition here. Unless we have a centre, and we must have a rotation to make a centre, we cannot have a substance. So this stuff out here, this hazy behaviour, is not memory. But in fact, it's continuously recrossing all the time. And in its perpetual recrossings, it actually draws every form in the world, so that wherever it goes, there's a form. If we care to abstract this particular one here, quite an accidental shape, you can see here that there's a bit of a Disney dog, a bit like a Pluto there, isn't it?
Yes.
This is very, very important, because this is not memory. This is what we call spirit. Spirit is the firstborn of the absolute. In the absolute, you do not define anything whatever. If you take the totality of all definables, throw them away, what remains is called the absolute. And its firstborn is spirit. For Plato, that spirit he called the demiurge, the creator, the half mover, because the other half of it is the absolute, which is forever, by definition, unknowable, because to know is to finite. And this is a movement of spirit without a rotation, and therefore without a center. And nevertheless, it contains all forms. And as the movement of spirit is light, those forms are light forms. So that in this spiritual light, all the forms that can come to be in existence already have their eternality. So we have to consider that all forms are in this hazy behavior of spirit, and yet that is not souled, because we said that the soul is this rotation of it. When we get a rotation, we have a center. When we have a center, we can talk about down. Down is D, own, isn't it?
Yes.
And unless you have a circumscription, you own nothing. So down is the same thing as circumscribed. Sub actually means breathing under the bait, the house. So there is the B again, the bait, English word booth, the house. All inside there is now called substance. What is outside is not substance. And this is the one we call M. This movement we call N, because it is not closed. We can say N with the mouth open. And we are using the tongue, the articulator, to make a form that is not closed. N, M. So N half M, or if you like, N plus another one to equilibrate it. That old-fashioned form of an N is out of equilibrium, isn't it? If we draw an earth line here, that tends to topple over, so that the N means disequilibrium and therefore motion. You know that scientifically there is no motion other than that which arises wherever there is a disequilibrium. Two forces which are unequal, there is necessarily a movement. If we put a prop under there, it goes into equilibrium and therefore cannot move. And when two forces are balanced, so that they're stabilized in their opposition, we have produced a center and a substance. So we can say that every substance, whatever, is a balance of opposing forces. And every substance is on the soul side of the absolute. Now, all creation occurs inside here, because creation, the root C, there's the letter C, put another one on it, becomes K. The root kra is the same as the word ark. This is the ark. This is the original Noah's ark. Remember the Greek word nous? I'll write with the English letters. Nous means this. The force that does that. But the force that does it is not the thing that is done. This is an orb. If we ignore it as a dynamic one and consider only its static aspect, we call it an ob. When we talk about the ob served, this is the ob served. The ob server is the force that comes in and keeps it going. So we say the ob server is not the ob served. Now, this closure we call substance, and we use the glyph M for it. The motion of it, N, is the same as this motion we call nous, which we said was simultaneous, didn't we? That was a simultaneous spiritual intuition. And we said that when we came inside here, it begins to rotate and makes the discursive reason. So we say every substance inside the soul is going round. And that going round is the form that is there, made to rotate. All this hazy form now, which contains absolutely all the possibilities of being at any level, has now been caught into the world soul. It's inside, but now it's going serially round, like the earth goes round the sun, and the sun goes round another point. So we say the world soul is a discursive mode of spiritual actuality. And because it has a center, we call it a substantial universe. And the absolute we do not call substance. Spinoza made an error about this. He should not have used the word substance for the absolute. He wanted to make a monism, and his name was Spinoza. Spinnen means to spin out. The word spinner in German means a spider, because it spins out a filament from itself. That filament is like this, and in Spinoza's mind, his mind was spinning out from one substance, the universe. Therefore we say he is the philosopher of substance. But he should not have equated the substance with the absolute, because the absolute is not circumscribed. Substance can only be circumscribed, and therefore the synagogue attacked him and said that he was saying God was material. And the rabbis knew very, very well that God was not substantial in their sense of the word. Spinoza was wrong, he didn't understand his terms. When they kicked him out, they should have done, because if they'd have allowed him to stay in, and if his doctrine had become orthodox, people would then have thought that God was a material. But the term God must be very, very carefully handled, because this one is called the second God. You get it in the Gospel of John, where in the beginning was the Word was God, and the Word was God. That's the use of the word God in two different significances. The Word was with God. And the God is the unbound, and God is the bound. So when we talk about God, we'll find even a good Catholic like Coventry Patmore saying, a man who believes that God is infinite just doesn't understand God. Well, he's talking about this circumscribed God. And that God is only an effect of the God. In the same way, Plato talks about good and the good. The good is absolute. It's underneath all this maze is the absolute. And that is the good. And it becomes the beautiful as spirit and the true as soul. It becomes the true when we put the T in it and consider the rotation. So we say the good, the absolute, the beautiful, the movement of spirit, the true, the ensouled spirit. So that although the good, the true, and the beautiful are three terms, you cannot equate them. They are not identical. And it is a mistake to say that they are three aspects of one substance. They are not. They are three attributes of the absolute. And we must be very careful not to use the word substance unless we are referring to that which has a center and a perimeter. So there we are. We have a circumscribed being, the world soul. And immediately we can see, in its simplest form, that this world soul here is cut off by that wall from the spirit which is outside. Now, one of the translations of the word Eden is a desert. Another one is a guarded place, wherefore we say garden. Here is a guarded place, and there is a desert. So that this D, Eden, that's D, the analysis function, which is a half circle, D, D, and M, the substance, is dome, D, D, O, and the flying of this motion locked up, dome. If we consider the MN, or closure, and the motion within it, and again the repetition of that substantialization, it produces another circle in here. We now have three. We'll shade this one in. Here is spirit, here is soul, and there is body in the middle of it. My body is inside my soul. My soul formulates the stuff I eat. So the soul is my unity principle that turns oranges and lemons into an identifiable being with some persistence of character. When we consider the substantial beat, vibrations within this boundary, that is what we call memory. It's simply the back and forward flying of what out there was hazy spirit is now trapped and flies about inside here and is called memory. Now in Plato there's a doctrine called the doctrine of anamnesis, where we take the word memory and we prefix it with the negative form a, and we call it the power to recall what has been forgotten, anamnesis. Here is the substantial soul, this is this one again, the world soul, all the motions that are trapped within it, because they have a boundary and a centre, are substantial. They contain all that you could possibly discover. Then you have a physical body inside here, and that physical body is being acted upon by spiritual forces going through here, some impinging on there and bouncing off, some coming through, some going through the body as in cosmic radiation. So that the internal state of your physical body is under constant stimulation from outside of three main orders. That is to say, the spiritual is running through it, you cannot break that. The soulish or psychic, the feeling stimulus, the actual contact of bodies, there's inside it a field, another soul, and another body. This body and that body can try to bang together and mutually stimulate each other. But memory is simply the flying backwards and forwards of the motions in that closed sphere. And there's nothing in the memory that doesn't derive from spirit. So the soulish memory has no new thing in it. There is no new thing under the sun. So every invention you could possibly invent is already here, waiting to be invented, that is, blown in to the sphere. When we come to consider death itself, we did this circle and divide it, that's the Greek letter phi, first letter of philosophy, which you should translate not, it's philosophia, wisdom and love. It is said to be the love of wisdom, but it isn't. It means love and wisdom, the two aspects of your being. Something you love, something you know. Your knowing is Sophia. Your loving is the philos. So philosophy does not mean the love of wisdom. It means love, wisdom. Wisdom, love. Both together. When that was introduced historically, incidentally, the word philosophy was introduced without a definition and became a great debating matter among the scholars as to what was its real definition, and certain men, for very definite purposes to blind, said it means the love of wisdom, thus directing men into an intellectual pursuit which could only stop them using their will, because the will side belongs to the love of you. The thing you love, you tend to do. The thing you know that you don't love, you don't do. So in effect, to say that philosophy is the love of wisdom is to split you and divert you into trying to get to know things. Whereas if you tried to find out what you're really fond of, you would discover that you derive your knowledge from what you attach yourself to. The thing that you feel inclined to devote yourself to pays back in knowledge. So philosophy means love, wisdom, wisdom, love. Not the love of wisdom. If we take the whole circle, that means the whole, and divide it, we're now separated out. There's the letter D, and it means divide. Here's the Red Sea. You know that Moses, when he went across the sea, smote it with a rod, and it was supposed to separate. The word in the Hebrew for the sea which he crossed is Mem Sof. And Mem Sof means sea of weeds, tangled. Now, this is the sea of the tangle, the backwards and forwards movements inside. The rod is this. Rod is the same thing, the old rude screen in the church with two O's. The door, which is Greek for a gift, with two O's, the thing you go through. This DR function means to differentiate. You must put the rod on it, measure it, and find out in all that what is like and group it all together. What is unlike, separate. Put the rod on it. Separate the sea of weeds. If you look in your imagination, you'll find it's all tangled. Put the rod of logic on it and look for the similars. And when you see them, they're grouped together automatically. That's Moses putting his rod on the mimps of sea of weeds. So, if we now take these two D's, as a matter of fact, they write them quite indiscriminately in ancient manuscripts, sometimes like a triangle, sometimes like that, sometimes like that, sometimes like that. So, if we want to write the word dead in, actually we've written it there already, D, O, D is dead. Turn it into a good English name and put an extra D on for special weight. Dod is the old Saxon English for death. We change D into T for German. T O D, thought, is death. And we keep the D and change this D into TH in English. D E A, which means earth. D-D-D-T, death. So, death means division. Doesn't mean anything else. That is subject to death, or division, which is made of parts. So, if there is a somewhat, I do not say a something, it would be a misuse of a term. If there is a somewhat which is not made of parts, then it is not subject to death. Because death means divine. This is why Paul says, there is no death. And yet, he says, death, where is thy sting? He means, there isn't a kind of a death, the death of your physical body can be cut up with knives. That's death. If you cut off portions of your body, the pieces you cut off die. They are D. They are D1. They are done. The devil is sometimes called the evil, the dividing evil. It's always a question of this division. When Christ divided or analysed the Pharisaic church, they said, he has a devil. He's an analytical fellow. He's cutting our tradition to bits. And if it's cut, people will see. It's like Moses putting the rod on the Egyptian tangle of Egyptian science and measuring it. Because Egypt means the material scientific world, symbolically. So, memory means this back and forward movement within the circumscription of the soul. Death means division, disintegration. At the intellectual level, it is analysis. When you cut an idea to bits, you really kill it. This is the whole meaning of modern psychology, where you analyse a person's complex, the thing he's afraid of, and you reduce it by analysis to its primary elements, and there is nothing to be afraid of. It has been killed. Its efficacy has been destroyed by analysis. In the same way, if you take an emotion and you analyse it and discover the source of the stimulus and why you reacted in that way, at the precise moment that you see that, it can no longer determine your activity because you have killed it, that is, analysed it and reduced it. So now we've got two things here. Death, which is simply division, and we say it can only occur to something which is compounded of parts. It therefore cannot occur to spirit. And it cannot occur to the soul spirit. This maze functioning here cannot be destroyed. It is called red wool in the Old Testament. And there's a reference to the red heifer and so on. Red means energy. And this absolute energy is a continuous thread. It's the one that Spinoza was trying to find. It's going about all the time, making all the forms there are. But it is continuous. It is the seamless, which when it rotates, becomes the seamless garment of Christ. You remember that he had the garment. They didn't cut it up. It was seamless, so they cast lots for it. It means that absolutely there is no division, and therefore no death. But when you make a thing like a body, which is a very low-level compound of motions, which are really linked together very loosely like this, there's a maze like this, and then there's another one like this, and you don't notice it, but really those two are continuous. But you can actually cause this one to bang on this one and fuse them together and make an apparently complex structure like this. This is exactly what goes on. Now you can see what happens if we do this. This is the basis of the Greek fret, incidentally, in architecture. There are apparently two beings in contact, aren't there? Because those are apparently, and apparent means a pi ratio function, apparent, appirat, because they're rotating. Because those two are apparently two, you can bang them together. And they will then fly apart. And what flies apart is not this thread, because that is eternally the unity. What flies apart is the appearance. This means, when it says nothing dies except what is fit for death, it means that only a false or a temporary compound can be pulled apart. That is one of these illusionary things. It appears that our physical bodies are separate. If I go like that with my hands, it appears that I have clapped my hands. But physical science knows that I cannot put together the matter of my fingers, because the field of an electron or a proton is so strong that I can't get into the atom by pressing my fingers together. Then what is there I can feel when I press? The answer is I can feel the resistance. So the physical body is to us a resistance and nothing else, a force. If I actually could put my fingers together like that really, then electrons would be knocked off both fingers and they would disintegrate. So that it is impossible for that centre and that to be put together. When I try to get them together, there's all this stuff in between, the red wall, the energy, the Ram's wall, and that is the resistance pushing out, and it pushes it apart. Now, if for a private purpose I have preferred to conceive those to be one, and held them together by my will, there's a terrific resistance, and for private reason I have called them one, and then I become tired, and I lose the power to overcome that internal resistance, they fly apart. And then I say, oh, good gracious, my dream is broken. And a dream is already a daydream. It's already a breaking. To dream is to break. Certain forms, fantasies we call them, which occur in the soul. Now we've defined what death is. It is division, disintegration, and at the intellectual level, analysis. We've defined what memory is, namely simply the circumscribed and closed motions of spirit trapped in the soul. And consciousness we're now going to define, and most philosophies start off with consciousness as an undefinable. They say we cannot define consciousness because to define is to circumscribe. In the same way, we cannot define the absolute because to define, defin, means limit. We cannot limit the absolute, therefore we cannot define it. But we can define ab, soul, ute, and put them together, and the three definitions cancel out and leave us with something, namely a suggestion in feeling, which we can apprehend the meaning of intuitively, that is, noetically. Not with the discursive rotating reason, but with the whole feeling of the organism. Consciousness, we said, is con, which is with, the root to see, S-C-I, and the issue thereof, and the essence at the end, and S, that's the same as essence. With seeing, issue, essence. The essence of the issue of sight, together. That means that in consciousness you must have more than one. In every act of consciousness there must be a seer and a seen, and you must deliberately refuse to become the seen thing, because if you do you will forget who you are. Here is an example. That one is an object to that one, because this one is vibrating and this one is vibrating. So the vibrations of this one modify this one a bit. And that is the percept by this one of that one, the modification in here produced by that one. To make it very simple, we'll just pretend for a moment that there are two beings in contact. And this one is always shouting, "I'm a square." And this one is always shouting, "I'm a skiffle." And the vibrations of this one are square. And the vibrations of this one are all like this, all the way through. So this one is imparting a square vibration to this one, like this. And this one is imparting this vibration. So there is a percept in here of SK and a percept in there of square. The habitual form, namely squareness, is the one that this being calls its individuality. The habitual SK-ness there is the one that that being calls its individuality. So the individuality is essentially form. So that when you talk about the difference between you and another person, you're talking about the form, about nothing else. If you remove all the form from two beings and then consider, you will find you've removed difference. And remember we said before, form is F-O-R, F-P-O-R, it's the pi ratio function, substantialized. Form is that. And individuation is in a state of divisibility. So we come back to this again. So that form is that which can be analysed. And it is that which you recognise as different from another being, because different means two doings. Di, two, facere, to do. Different means doing two things at once. So the different is necessarily dual. And in consciousness, you always have this seer seen. The seer with which you identify is not the real observer. It is the observed. If a man named John Smith says, "I, John Smith, saw today a rabbit or a hare lying in front of a bus," then he has referred and said, "I, John Smith." He has said, "I," and the Egyptians just draw an eye to symbolize I, the ego, the observer. But that ob here, the eyeball, has in the middle a pupil, a learner. That learner looks out and he sees a little box. If attention does not go out to the eye, you don't see anything. I can hold that in front of my eye and ignore it. And if I attend to it, then I see it. Something must go out of the eye, we call attention. Physically, dynamically, it is a tension. Psychologically, we call it an act of attention. But it is physically a tension. Then I say, I, referring to this I, the formal structure, have seen a box. The box is reflected into my eye. But really, behind the individuated eye that I can name, if we go right back through the soul, through the world soul, to the spirit, we find there is no difference whatever between any one of the centres of all the beings in the universe. Christ says some things apparently contradictory. He contradicts himself when he says, "I do not judge, nevertheless, if I judge righteous judgment." And he's going like this. He knows what he's looking at. If I say, "I don't judge anybody," the I refer to is that. If I say, "I do judge anybody," the I refer to is this. And if I said, "I judge badly," the I would refer to would be this one, the physical body. Because my physical body, pressed by stimuli from outside, varies under different conditions. If I read a book for 4 hours, and then look down the road, it's a bit out of focus. Because I've strained the muscles. I falsify what I see. So if I said, "I, the physical body, see," I would say, "I see wrongly." The Greeks knew very well that when a message comes into your body, it is necessarily distorted by your physical body. And therefore they said, truth would be impossible to gain unless there were some movements, which they identified with fire, spirit, so fine that they could penetrate through the interstices of the physical body and thus get into the soul without being interfered with. But even there, he said, you have to be very careful because they may be coming through other layers of interfering spirit. So if we say there is a source of light and there is an earth, very dark, and on it there is a man. The man is standing here and he looks this way and the sun is setting. What colour is the sun? The earth has an atmosphere around it. When the sun is low on the horizon, the amount of atmosphere it penetrates there is greater than when the sun is at the zenith, isn't it? Therefore, the refraction and the absorption of the light of the sun is different at sunset than it is at noon. And it's different at dawn. Because after the air has been warmed, its refractive power is changed by the heat. So the man could not tell you the colour of the sun unless he could climb into a void where there is no interference and guarantee that his organs of perception are not distorting. So there is only one way to know the truth certainly, and that is to climb out of the physical body consciousness. Don't rely on your gross physical senses. You check and counter-check those. Don't rely on the discursive reason, because that is conditioned by the messages that have gone through your five senses. Climb up beyond discursive reason, which you do by stopping the mental process, and feeling for the totality, you then find you slip out beyond this limit, and you become aware of this. And in that are all the forms that you could possibly find out, because it contains absolutely all the forms that later in this rotating process are called past, present and future. Remember that the place where the earth will be in July this year is already in the solar system waiting for the earth to get to it. So it is now, that future is now. And the winter that we will be in is there waiting, and the earth will get round into it. And when it gets there, the conditions which are there, when it gets there, are being formed now, so that when it gets there, they'll be ready for it. This is how, if we look at the thing wholly, there is no past or future, but there is only an eternal now. Hence, that word now, if you reverse it, is the word one. It's the victory. Because if you can keep your mind on the now all the time, you don't allow discursive processes to fool you. You don't speculate backwards like Epimetheus. You don't anticipate like the live-a-bird Promethean liver-gnawing gentleman. You keep your mind bang on the moment and attend to what you're doing. And there follows then an influx from spirit through the soul into consciousness. Consciousness being the product of the duality of the observer and the observed. So consciousness is the essence of the issue of seeing together. We put two things together, and the resultant of them in the spirit is consciousness. If we take one of them away, let's put that on its own and identify with it. Suppose we look at that and ignore everything else in the room, we will become what a psychiatrist would call monoideistic. We'd be stuck. We'd be incapable of saying what we're looking at, because we would have nothing to judge it against. To remind ourselves what that is, we put one of those by the side and say, that is not that. So we put a circle, that's a square, that's not a square, that one's a circle. All judgment involves the denial of something other than the thing we're talking about. So now we've got three processes. We've got the memory and death. Death means division. It can happen to a physical body, which is only an illusionary complex, which is fundamentally a continuum. This is how Christ can raise his body, because really the physical molecules that are destroyed can be gathered together again, if you wish it, and if it's worth it. If the situation is such that it's worth continuing in, you could gather together again those forms which are eternal and re-manifest your body. As in the case of some of the ancient sages, some of the Old Testament characters, their bodies were assumed. That is, the apparent complex is there, change their frequencies as the man changes awareness of them, and became invisible at the gross level by simply altering the distances between centers, which is the same thing as altering the wavelength, the frequency. And you can only respond at frequencies at the level at which you concentrate. So the question of the resurrection is not mechanically really difficult at all, because all the forms that comprise his body were there, they were gathered together by active will, they were loosened by active will. And notice he didn't stay around when he'd finished his work. He proved the point of the resurrection by running around amongst his friends, and then he withdrew because he'd finished his work. So he didn't hang about demonstrating the possibility of continuously doing it. He had given a stimulus when he said to the disciples, "If I do not go, the Paraclete cannot come." He meant to say, "You have been putting too much stress on the external in me, and now if I take it away, it will force you to introvert your attention and discover the equivalent in yourselves of that which you thought was only in me." He was trying to teach them all the time about the Father. He said, God is a spirit. The spirit is this wandering about which produces all these forms. That is the world soul. That is the spirit which is the God. The reason he did not simply say God is any old spirit is because spirit means form. There is form here. This is form, not static, but dynamic. You see, and we can actually find that some forms, taken in isolation, like this one here, you see, I'll put a funny hat on him, it's quite legitimate, and he's smoking a pipe. Now we can say that form is not the best form, but it is a possible form. So we mustn't say that God is a definite spirit, because if we did, we'd say, well, which one? So he says God is a spirit. Now you find out which spirit. Not a bad spirit, but a spirit. And he's talking not about the circumscribed God, but about the free, Mrs. Free, Mrs. Dome. His worship is perfect, free dome. There's the domain of your soul, and here is the free, the energy, which surrounds it and gives you continuous stimulation to remind you that you're not necessarily a circumscribing, discursive reasoner. You can get out of it. You can go back to your source. You can go back to it by simply shifting the accent. Shifting the accent does not destroy these rotations. It merely carries you over here so you can see what they mean. And you can, if you wish, see those as standing still, or you can see them as moving by altering your frequency. You could select a little bit and examine it. That requires a certain amount of self-control, but you can slow down your impressions. Some drugs do this artificially, make you see everything very slowly. Some others make your percepts accelerate like a fever does. So there's nothing absolute about the speed of your reasoning process, because even physical things like chemicals can cause changes in your perceptive rate. So that great frightener of people, death, simply means division, and nothing can be divided that is not compounded, but nothing has any reality if it is compounded. It is apparent only. So that when we say this, there are apparently two beings. We find those on all the ancient potteries and architectural entablatures and so on, friezes. The Greeks squared them up like this. You've seen them often enough, and they just go on repeating this. That's what we call a Greek threat. And it simply is a squared off form of this. And the Greeks were very fond of it because it said every man is an individual and belongs to spirit. And no man, therefore, is justified in dictating to another man from his individuality. This is an absolute refutation of all dictatorships, because if we say that is Adolf Hitler, we're using a term up to there because it vibrates in a certain way. But as the force going into it does not belong to it, it has no right to dictate either to what precedes it or to what comes after it. So this completely shows that at all times the imposition by one finite being on others is metaphysically wrong. We can reduce all those quite simply in that sign of the zodiac we had before, the sign of Taurus, where this means the spirit, the paralogic. This is the realm of the discursive reason, and we deliberately, to keep the diagram clear, we take the cross there, which is the body, and append it down there. Now the body means a compound. There's one thing and there's another laid on top of each other. But the compound is always of this nature. It is a compound of a continuous force behaving as if it was separate when it is not. So that from that you can see precisely what Paul meant, there is no death. Now there are two deaths mentioned in the New Testament, and one is called the first death and the other is called the second. The first death is the death of your physical body. It's when a bus comes along and hits you and it damages it so much you say it's not worth remaining here, so you let go of it. That's the first death. But the second death is the death or disintegration of all the ideas you had if they were erroneous. If they are not erroneous ideas, they will not break because they define each other. Just like a triangle, if we say a triangle is a three-sided figure and its internal angles add up to so much and the length of the sides have a certain relationship, those are necessary definitions of the relations of a triangle. So they cannot be broken. Given one, we can always construct the others. But in the case of an erroneous idea, like Maggie McTavish hates Paddy O'Brien, that is a statement that a being does something in relation to another being, both being finite. It's like saying that one is so-and-so to that. Mm-hmm. It denies that that thing is changing all the time. So that an erroneous idea is one where the form is such that the moment you remove the external pressure, it runs away. Error means running away. So, the second death means the disintegration of all the ideas you have inside you, which will not integrate together so that they can define themselves in a circle. Tautology is the Greek word for definition in a circle, where you define a thing as what it is and change the words. As we say, a triangle is a three-angled figure, triangle. There's our circle and there's our cross. That's the glyph of Christianity. The Chris is cross. Kreis is the German word for a circle. Eis is the German word for ice, which is freezing. Ei is the German word for egg. That's I, the egg. And that's the centre here. The Hiranyagarbha of the Hindu is the cosmic egg. Kra means to create. The whole process, shurek, backwards in the Hebrew, the circle and the cross contains all that is. If we take it out and draw it like this, we can easily see that is our eight, there's the circle, and the continuous rotation and bisection of that angle produces this cross and the circle. That's the oldest form of the swastika we have, isn't it? And we take it out and do this. It's really an abstract form of that. When it's drawn this way around, it is said to be good, clockwise. When we draw it this way around, it is said to be bad, anti-clockwise. Clockwise means to will. Anti-clockwise means to think. The native hue of resolution is sickened over the pale cast of thought. You've got will. Clarify your will and then do it. If you think about it too much, you will undo it. So you cannot clarify yourself by thinking. You can only clarify yourself by feeling whether you are being bad or good in your intent. If you say, am I feeling destructive or helpful at the moment, it clarifies. But if you won't say that and you think, you will not solve the problem. This anti-clockwise swastika means thinking. This one means willing. This one is called bad, that one is called good. Yet both together constitute the double wheel of life, and therefore this problem. In Buddhism we find the same swastika form, we find the same emblem in China in disguise, in this form, where half of it is made dark, with a white spot in it, and the other half is light, with a dark spot in it. It's the dialectical symbol, tag he, and it means the world is half dark, half light, but in the dark there is a light, and in the light there is a dark. So the world is like a man. Where he is most ignorant, he knows. Where he is most knowledgeable, he is ignorant. This is the dialectical process that enables you to release yourself all the time from thinking that you know what you don't know, or that you don't know what you do know. That, if we draw it like this, and that's one of the earliest forms of it, and we just put the dot there and tie that, and the other dot there is back to the Hebrew letter Aleph, which if we write it like this down there, and to save time we go right up there, and then we do it like this, is our Greek letter Alpha, our own small letter A, which we write like that. So there's the evolution of the letter. And this is a glyph of the absolute. So now we've got what consciousness is. It is seeing things together, using one as a reference point while you measure the other. Like you use a ruler with inches on it to measure a piece of string with no inches on it. You need something to measure by. So if you judge a situation, you look at your own organism, and then you say, I don't like that thing over there. Now liking means like, being similar to. Doesn't mean anything else. So if a man says, I do not like Dr. Fell, and the reason why I cannot tell, etc., it means he is not constituted in the same way. So a statement of liking is really a self-portrait. So if you tell somebody what you like and what you don't like, you've told them something about you, not about the thing. So then to express an opinion is to expose yourself. Hence the Rose Cross statement, to speak is to fall. In diplomatic circles, the rule is, you don't ever tell a lie, and you never tell the truth. But you always use a question to ask the other fellow what he thinks about it. And you always use another question to reply to his question. And may the best man win. Is that fairly clear now, the relation between them? Is there anything else arising out of this at the moment?
When we say we exist in consciousness, this means that we have the ability to do that. Because we exist, we can observe.
Because there is an existence, there can be an observing. Well, exist is existere, isn't it? Out of six. This is Latin for to be six. And that was the wheel. Remember, there's the gamma and there's the lambda. There's the six-spoked wheel. That is existence. To exist is to be. And to be is to be circumscribed. So that there is an arm to be served. So if there is such, it is inside the spirit, which is not rotating. And this spirit is the nous, the immediate intuitive apprehension. So that it is that knows that. If it attends to it, it's a serving arm, and we call it the observer. But if it won't attend to it and goes away, we say that's not the observer. Usually what attends in there is one portion of that, there are six. One is a coordinator, The other five are your five senses. The one we call the common sense or mind. And the little portion of that, through stimulus from outside, becomes the habitual reference point and starts serving the whole of. Thus, we say of a boy, are you very strong? And he says, not very. And what will you become when you grow up? And he says, I think I'll be a missionary. Now, he's felt inside himself as something that won't overtax him in the competitive market of commercial values. And he imagines, in another land where there are only savages, I will take a message, and it won't be very difficult. So I'll be one of those. Now, he's used a reference point, namely certain feelings of deficiency, which are only concepts in him, and he's then used it to serve the rest of the ob. He identifies with that and calls that the observer. And you can make any part of yourself serve the whole of you. If you like, as an exercise, you can say, I will take, on a Monday, I will deliberately go about and not know what I'm talking about. Because everybody else on a Monday has got a hangover through bad golf on a Sunday, and they're a bit testy, and they're not good to meet first thing Monday morning if you're a commercial traveller, are they? So you say, on that day, I'm going to moon in the opposite sense. The moon has two aspects, counting and not counting. Male counting, female not counting, feeming. So you may say, I take the complex in myself that tends to refuse to define, and I'll deliberately go through the whole of Monday without a definition. That is making that concept your reference point and the observer. On Tuesday, you say, most people make war, which is Tuesday, Mars Day. On Tuesday, I shall deliberately go about talking about pacifism and the necessity for abandoning the pursuit of orders. And every commercial traveller I meet, I shall say to him, you're wasting your time. As an exercise, always contradicting the mood of the day. This is taking a complex and making it serve as the observer. People are doing that all the time, but they don't know it. Sometimes mothers impose on children, sometimes fathers impose on them a dominant complex which they then think is the observer. And they feed all their energy into that concept and bolt through it up. We know a lady with only one leg who's making her son into a ballet dancer, don't we? Why? If she'd have had five legs, would it have occurred to her? We can't tell. Very, very often one person is pillaged for another person's deficiency. So the observer may change from moment to moment. You can strike on somebody, and Bloomer says, where is the hammer that can strike my bell? A man is going out for full revenge, and you say, you're not as little as that, are you? You're bigger than that. And another comes that goes, click, and he glows inside, no, I'm bigger than revenge. I just heap coals of fire on heads, I do. That's a new observer. And these things can be displaced all the time by a stimulus from outside.
There is one other point. You referred the other week, this came up the other night, to the sensorium of getting experience. How far does the body go in localizing, so that the brain differentiates a greater degree than the other cells? This doesn't deny the other cells their own particular memory. The total being is a sensorium, isn't it?
Well, remember we said about the M, it means a closure.
Yes.
So a sensorium is necessarily enclosed. It's a soul statement, not a spirit. That is not sensorium. This is sensorium.
Yeah.
There can be no sense in the world unless there is compaction. Compaction makes stimulus, and sense arises from stimulation. So the sensorium is simply the circumscribed spirit, which when we call it circumscribed, we change the name to soul. Now, when a stimulus comes to it, the stimulus puts a ripple up. If another stimulus is put in here, a pattern arises between the two. And it may happen quite accidentally, as far as the individual is concerned, that the product of two stimuli produces a shape in there. And he thinks, oh, I like that shape, I'm very fond of that shape. I'll use that shape as a reference point central to my character.
I see, we're forgetting that the physical body actually exists within this.
So, oh, yes.
Well, that's, yes, that is. Well, so the tendency, really, of a person looking for a particular part of the physical body as the seat of certain activities is really a falsity, isn't it?
Yes, because things like this can happen. The brain is zoned habitually. Mm. So much so that brain physiologists experiment to localize particular activities. And experimentally and statistically, they find that certain zones are, in general, used for certain functions. But if one of those zones gets damaged, sometimes after a certain lapse of time, the function that was destroyed reappears, although that part of the brain has not been repaired. Mm. Another part of the brain is now being used for the same function. So the function was not really tied to that part of the brain. It merely habitually localized itself there. Mm. This means that all the functions are inside the soul. And the body is inside the soul. And the soul, spontaneously, if the body is a good one, works through certain centres. For instance, it's a matter of pure logic that if we want to separate the rule and the breaker of the rule, we want a space between them.
Yes.
So we put down here the belly urge, and we put up there the negative principle, the noose, and we say keep those two separate, because if that one gets up there, there's going to be trouble. The reason goes to bits. In fact, if the chemistry of sexuality rises up into the head, it produces fantasy. So we have a buffer between it here, the chest, and we have a diaphragm across there to help shield. And we have this raised up on a stretcher, so the cord running through there can take messages through and is relatively shielded in the brain. So that the whole of this is, here's the soul, those are three centres, there's the axis. You know that the egg, when it splits, polarizes, and there is an axis appears around which the spine will be created, with a north and south. The north means the negative, and the south means the expressive. And it is natural that the soul, to keep different functions separate, will use opposite parts of the body. But if you destroy certain parts, and manage to do it very, very carefully so that you don't kill the being with shock, the soul then starts using other centres. For instance, a friend of mine who specialised in, an Indian boy who would specialise in this, could read a book with his big toe. And say he ran his toe over the book and could read it like that, about that speed.
Really?
Yes. It isn't as strange as it should be. If you remember that the original cell, which has no nerves in it at all, is sensitive to light, it absorbs food, it experiences rudimentary taste, smell, touch, sight and hearing, all of which you can prove. Because you can take an amoeba, very simple, single cell. You can subject it to sonic stimulation, which to it is touch. Or you can tap it with a little piece of straw, if you like. Or a hair, or you can put something in the water to it, change the constitution, some of it's unpleasant, some pleasant. You can give it five types of stimulation, and yet it hasn't specialized. This is why in Indian metaphysics we say panchakarana. The universe is a fivefold sensorium. So that originally we see simultaneously. Just like if you care to concentrate for a moment on the pressure of your body on the floor, instead of on the ears, you suddenly become aware that there's some weight there, which while you were attending to the sound of the words, you forgot about, but it's there. You can deliberately keep that feeling and say, what did I have for supper last night? And recall the smell and taste of it while you are listening. It's a question of practice. Before analysis, the fivefold sensorium is a simultaneous apprehension of the stimulus situation. And later on, they are separated out because they're more efficient when they're separated out, And it's from this we prove a very funny thing. It is the exact opposite of what it teaches you in a book of nervous physiology, where the nervous system is supposed to be a means of communication. But it isn't. It's a means of not communicating. Suppose we put in here a nuclear centre, and already a stimulus going in there can fly all over the place. And when a baby is born, it first begins to try to sit up, its whole body trembles. When it starts to walk, it throws its arms about. It sends messages all over its body, like an amoeba does. And gradually it begins to restrict that general nervous distribution into certain nerve channels. So that really the nervous system is a system of negation, not a system of communication, but a system of insulation to stop the nervous impulse going from any place other than the one you want to get it to. You see the idea? Suppose that we take a portion of substance and we get a neuron, we get a cell that's going to grow a filament, which is a nerve. And one end of it is going to connect with another source. This end is going to grow. Supposing there's a muscle over here. Actually, on the end of that, under a microscope, there's a little knob. And it pushes its way, just like a spider, and it trails this filament behind it. And it is going through a gradient. We call this a chemical gradient. If it moves to the right or the left or up or down, it is bitten with a certain acidity in this gradient. It is more pleasant for it to go along there. And when it gets there, it begins to branch around the muscle. It has laid a line of least resistance. And the nerve is insulated so that nervous impulse is put in there and run right along there to the muscle instead of spreading around the whole being. The nervous system is therefore a negative method of stopping leakage in all directions in order to become directional. So we say it's a teleological structure. It aims at definite ends. And it is laid down, the form of it is laid down in the soul before the nervous system is made. And it appears in the physical body as chemical gradients before the physical nerve is actually grown. And because those gradients are there dynamically, chemical changes are produced. Because those chemical changes are produced, when the nerve starts to grow, it has to grow in the definite direction, predetermined by the nature of the soul. And the nature of that soul is conditioned by its ancestors. By the function of its ancestors, which have precipitated a soulish pattern. That's why we say we are born in sin. Adam wanted to do certain things. The motivation of his soul acted upon the eggs in him and conditioned them chemically so that they tended to act in a certain way. That is being born in sin. Sin means separation from the whole good. We are being driven by ancestral impulses in various erroneous directions. Erroneous means running away from the point. Someday we'll run back again. Everybody will run back eventually. So we have to see this question of localization, you see. In the solar plexus you have a center there. In the soul,
yes.
You see, the solar plexus is the chief center in the body. I'm excluding the head for a moment. In this torso here, the solar plexus is the chief doorway into the soul. That's why if you're going across the road and you hear a horn behind you and you bounce onto the pavement, you feel a jolt in there. That jolt is not in your physical tissue, it's in the soul. And it produces a shock in the frequencies of the physical body nearest to the soul frequencies. That's why D.H. Lawrence said, "I put my face in the solar plexus." You see, he was so sensitive to its messages, it could tell you, if you listen to it, if there's going to be an earthquake. Because it's tremendously sensitive to changes in the dynamic condition of the ether, the electromagnetic condition of the earth, all act on there. So if you become very, very aware, you become aware of minor depressions that you wouldn't have noticed before. And you can say, I've done something wrong. I can feel it. There's a fox's paw being dropped. There is a depression. It is never wrong. And it only tells you when you made a mistake. That's very, very important. It never tells you when you've done anything right, that centre. Only when you've done something wrong. Socrates described his demon. He said, my demon is infallible. But he never speaks except to say no. Because you are free to do any good you can imagine. And if you drop a clanger, that's where you'll feel it, in the solar plexus. So there is a centre that warns you when you made a mistake. So you can do what you like if you're sensitive, providing that doesn't say don't.
What about keeping your attention there? Same as with the older breathing.
Well, you have to be very careful about yoga breathing. Yoga breathing has nothing to do with your physical body. European versions of yoga breathing are quite erroneous. They're, what are they, commercialized and propagated by soldiers that happened to get sent to India during the war, and being physical culture men, they came back surrounded with an aura of glory and set up as a yogi school of philosophy or something. The whole of the centres mentioned in all valid books on yoga in India is concerned not with the physical body. The centres they mention are not in the physical body, they're in the subtle body. And breathing has to be done subtly. You can actually breathe in while you're physically breathing out. In fact, that's a very good exercise to find the difference. You imagine you're breathing in, you expand your lungs, and at the same time, you shift your attention to realize that you're throwing something out because your chest is expanding. Breathe in and see.
Yes, right.
Breathe in and think to myself, I'm pushing something out. And you get another sensation outside your physical body as if you're pushing something to the limit. And then when you breathe out physically, imagine you're sucking something in. Because the soul and the body are polarized. This makes you aware of centers quite different from the physical nerve plexi in the spine. The chakras, the lotuses of the Hindus, are not the nerve plexi in the spine. They are related to them, but they are not them. They're not quite in the same place. They're only approximately in the same place, and they can move about.
Could we use the idea of rhythmic breathing to further our process of integration?
Only providing you keep to the right ratio. You see, there's a 1-4-2 ratio which must be observed in yoga breathing. Because if you don't use that ratio, you will introduce a disharmony into your body. If you breathe in 1, you hold 4 and you exhale 2. So if you breathe in 4, you hold 16, exhale 8. It's 1-4-2 ratio. And you must keep it that way. And furthermore, you must not hold your breath by choking yourself. You must hold it by holding your lungs expanded, your diaphragm in the right position. You mustn't choke it here. You must just hold it. Because if you choke it there, you can, if you're stupid enough, say doing a count 1-4-2 with 1 equals 64. You see, on the in-breath, you can get a hemorrhage. Quite easy. A lot of stupid people have done that because they don't know anything about it. If you hold the breath in on a full chest and get very obstinate about it and determine you won't let it out, you can rupture something inside. Actually, the cells in the chest, in people that use the lungs a great lot, say like pearl divers and so on, they gradually become enlarged, stretched, and they can break down through that. It is dangerous to hold the physical breath in on a full chest. It is not nearly as dangerous to hold it out. But the real breathing exercise physically is simply to calm your breathing, nothing else. Just calm it. But the basic exercise of all is just say to yourself, the breath is going in, the breath is going out, the breath is going in, the breath is going out. You're using the breath as a support, then, for observation of emotional states. And if you switch on to the breath and make it go slowly out and slowly in without holding it at all, you will discover at certain points a tendency to grip it. And at these points, if you examine quickly, you'll find an idea in your mind. Because if you come to an idea of fear or of possession, you will hold your breath. Before aggression, you suddenly hold your breath, don't you? And before something you really want, you hold your breath. So if you try to make your breath very, very smooth, about 4 seconds in and 4 out, without any pause either end, the difficulty of doing that will focus the mind. And if you try any monkey business of holding your physical air in your physical lungs under compression, which is what it is when you've shut it here, you can do yourself damage. And quite a lot of damage has already been done by these pseudo yogis. The important thing is not to do anything really, except watch your will, your motive, your feeling, your soul state. If the spirit in you is true, the soul will become harmonious. If the motive in you is a true motive, it harmonizes the soul. If your soul is harmonious, it will harmonize your body. So you should always keep it the right end, the causal end. Suppose when we take the rosary, there's the continuous line, there's a bead, see? There's another bead. There's a very big bead, that's called a pater bead. Then we'll go out together and have a Hail Mary bead there, and then another one, and so on. Now, this is the thread, and these are the beads. But really the whole thing is a continuum. Now, you can consider this as like breathing. Try to reduce your breathing. Not by holding your breath, but quite freely. Try and breathe slower and slower. Because when you breathe slowly, there is a nervous relation between the rate of your breathing, the beating of your heart, and the activity in the brain. If you put your finger inside the brain of a sheep and feel its pulse at the same time, you will find that the brain is going like this. And it's coordinated with the heart in a certain way. So your thinking and your heartbeat and your breathing are linked like a triangle. You can't get hold of your brain immediately. You can't get hold of your heartbeat immediately at first. Later you can. But you can immediately get hold of your breathing. So imagine you're saying rosary to yourself. This is its origin. Rosary means develop the differences and integrate. Rose means develop. Ar means differentiate. The white then means integrate. Develop through analysing and integrating. Quieten yourself. At a certain point you feel a little jump. Be very quick, saying, what startled me then? It was an idea. And as soon as you've seen what it is, reduce the breathing again. Go along. After a bit you'll find your breathing goes, look quickly, it's another idea. Reduce it again. Go along, you might find a big one, a big shock. Then you might hear cursing. It's old Harry Sanso who did it last Tuesday. You pull it down. Reduce the breathing again. Try to get the breathing down. The idea is to breathe so that you don't breathe. There's nearly a stasis in the breath. It isn't that you're not breathing. You are breathing, but you're breathing through the soul. Your physical breath is just going like this inside. There's a slight movement, a vibration. And it doesn't come out of the nostrils. You can feel it. Somewhere at the back there, and it's just a column of air between there and there, and it's going like that, and it isn't coming out. That's the condition you get in if you want to be buried for a few years. You just make the breath halt. And then you're breathing through the soul. And it's the same energy you need that you get out of oxygen, only it's at a different frequency. Sometimes people go into cataleptic conditions. Sometimes they go into conditions that are so nearly death that you have to be very careful that you don't define that person as dead when he's not. I had an aunt like that was actually in a coffin in Lancaster. And she'd been brought down the steps. There were 5 stone steps to be brought down and put up. And 2 of the coffin bearers were a bit shorter in the leg than the others and tilted it a bit like that. And they were just sliding her in. And they heard a banging on the inside of the coffin. and nearly dropped it. She lived 15 years after that. She'd gone into a funny kind of coma, you see. Instead of waiting for it to start smelling, they were so glad to get rid of her blessed release, they bunged her in the box and sent her off. She was a very strong-willed and vexatious old lady.
All the pilgrims coming back from Mecca dies, and they bury him in the earth quickly and hurry on. And the warm sand revives him again, and he gets out of it and manages to stagger across the desert 500 miles with better in hell, and turns up at home, by which time they've divided out all his property and aren't at all pleased to see him.
Yes.
That the body was inside the soul.
The division. Yes. But remember, that division is only apparent. Realize that these beams, there's the force, going round and then out again like that. And then on to the next one. You see that? Now, that is what we would call a soul.
Individual soul.
An individual soul, yes. We say individual because we can divide it from this one.
It's not outside the physical body, though, is it?
The physical body is inside the soul.
Is it?
Most people think their soul is about as big as their thumb. See, and in some Indian manuscripts it says so. But it's symbolic because the thumb means the will. Little Tum Thumb is the will fellow. It's a euphemism. It's a phallic statement. It means generative power, as big as your thumb. It means absolute.
Oh, I think you've got the wrong one.
Is there any connection between the soul and the aura?
Well, what you call the aura is surrounding your physical body, isn't it? And the aura is simply a force circulating in the soul, inside which is the body. The body is formed by a force bigger than the body. If you like, your physical body is a precipitation inside the soul. In some ways, if the soul were really smaller than the body, it couldn't control it. Supposing we had a government in the country and we had no police force. Supposing the Queen sat on her throne and said, I hereby command that everybody shall pay taxes. And sent out a lot of pieces of paper, but everybody said, the Queen has no army, so we're not going to reply to these. She must have an executive power that goes right to the limit of her authority to circumscribe everybody. Otherwise they won't pay taxes. In the same way, unless the body is inside the dominion of the authority of the soul, but then it cannot be made coherent by the soul. Your soul is bigger than your body. The tendency is to think that your soul is as big as that, but that is a symbolic statement. When Christ says, the letter killeth, he means just that. In Indian books he says, the soul is as big as your thumb. But it's a euphemism. Thumb means phallic energy. Phallic energy means universal energy. It means spiritual energy. Your soul is as big as the absolute. Only you will persist in identifying it with your physical body and then looking in the physical body for the soul. And the centre of it is in your body, but not the perimeter. The perimeter of it is nowhere. Medieval scholasticism, following Aristotle, said the centre is anywhere of God and the circumference is nowhere. Bruno came along and said, that makes every man a centre and everybody can do as he likes. So they burned him. He said, Bruno by name and Bruno by nature.
So when a man becomes immortal, he becomes immortal, does he go back to the absolute, the hazy business, or is he still within the
circumscribed? Well, if you remember, in that hazy stuff, all the forms that can possibly arise are there eternally, aren't they?
Yes.
We'll arbitrarily select one and say, there it is. That one, it's you. That's you. That is an eternal actuality, not a potentiality. An eternal spiritual actuality. When you identify with it and say, ah, that is myself, you start accreting in there and you build a body inside it. That body is inside. Now, after a time, you get fed up with that body because, like all compounded things, it finally bores you. You say, there's nothing in this. Why live in Liverpool forever? I think I'll die out of it or something. Dying simply means you disintegrate that thing and remember that. Now, if you remember spirit, you then become aware of all this again, but that does not cease to exist. That is, what you are, you have always been, and always will be. But you can concentrate on your physical body and make one. You can let go of that when it begins to disintegrate and concentrate on the soul, or you can concentrate on the spirit, in which case the soul is still in there and will still tend to make bodies periodically if you don't stop it. That is, it will always tend to accrete at its centre. A man becomes immortal not as to his soul, that is already eternal. He becomes immortal. Mortal means breakable. Mort means breakable. To be immortal is to be unbreakable, and it refers to the body of ideas, of truth. If you can analyze and disintegrate them, then it is a mortal body. This is a reference to the second death again. The second death is the death of your body of ideas, the erroneous ideas. If you haven't got erroneous ideas, you have an immortal body. And that body is owned by the soul, who is eternal. You mustn't equate eternality with mortality. You mustn't equate it with immortality. Mortality is breakability. Immortality is non-breakability and refers to that which is compounded. But immortal is tautological, that is, if it defines itself all the time. And eternity is the absolute itself, not as a temporal process enduring, but as that in which time itself takes place. Eternity is quite beyond time. It isn't a lot of time added up. Time is rotation within eternity. Eternity is really a trinity, the threefold spiritual absolute. So earning immortality simply means working to integrate your ideas so they cannot be broken up. In other words, the elimination of false placing of ideas, because every idea is valid in its right place. It is only erroneous if it runs out of that place and won't stay in it.
And there's no particular place for immortality. It's here as well as there.
Yes, well, place you have to be careful of, because place is always marked by beings, isn't it? Supposing we blow up the earth and reduce it to cosmic dust, and then that cosmic dust is drawn away by a passing comet. Now, is there a place where the earth was? No. You see? There isn't one. Place means that which is marked by some individual. What is not marked, it's called space. But if you say place, you presume it to be marked. So if you disintegrate all the matter in the universe, so there isn't any, then there is no place. There's plenty of space left. But to make places, you'll have to precipitate. To be in place, notice they're all ace. Ace is an old form of H, which means spirit. Space is simply the spirit pacing along, it's moving. The pace at which it moves is the time process. The pi lace, or lace of the pi ratio, is the place. When it rotates, that's the place. If it doesn't rotate, there's no place, there's just space. So we measure from place to place through space at pace. The ace always means spirit. That's why in a pack of cards you have ace high, ace low. Ace high is called spirit transcendent, beyond the soul, beyond the world soul. Ace low is called spirit immanent in the individual, below the deuce. deduces the duality principle. So you're immortal where you are. And you mark out the place where you are, regardless of where you move to.
So that we could be mortal and eternal.
Simultaneously. Well, your body of ideas could be mortal, it could be disintegrating. In fact, this is what is meant by hell. You see, your soul is eternal because it is spirit going like this, and spirit is eternal. You see, what is the meaning of being cast eternally into outer darkness? If the ideas to which you give yourself are erroneous, they're always falling to bits. Now, supposing you've got a body of ideas that are falling to bits all the time, and suddenly a bus hits you, and your physical body, the means of your education, is destroyed. You now find yourself in the soul with your second body, that's your body of ideas, falling to bits inside you. You've got no reference that will stay. You are therefore in a state called hell. You're in a state of torment. Where's my security? All these ideas are flying away. I'm disintegrating. If you're identified with the ideas, which are erroneous, as they're flying to bits, you feel terrible. But if you say, that's only ideas, I'm a soul, you don't feel terrible.
Well, when they've all flown away, how do you know that
you're... Well, you feel void. You feel, oh, I've got nothing.
You feel
void. You say, oh, my ideas have fled. Poor me. You see, it's a feeling. The soul is essentially the feeling me. Thinking is idea, which is form. Thinking is serial presentation at our level, the ordinary level we're at now discussing. Serial presentation of ideas is thinking, which is thinging. Reflecting things in the mind discursively is thinking. It goes round in the soul. It informs the soul, as we say, giving it information. If the information is erroneous, it will fall to bits. If your physical body has been broken and you've got a soul full of rubbish, and you look at it and say, that's rubbish, you feel terrible. But if you're a dialectician, you say, rubbish is good manure. So I'm going into business. You see, now, a proper good Jew means the mysterious perfection of God himself, if he knew he'd only got rubbish inside him, he would set up in business. Selling errors. And he'd advertise a whole lot, knowing that somewhere they fit. And somebody wants precisely that error to make his setup complete.
There's a very close link between the soul frequency reaction in the solar plexus and normal feeling reaction.
Very close, yes. You notice how remarkably speedy that solar plexus reaction is, don't you? It's quicker than your thought process, isn't it? The thing that operates in you when you get out of the way of a bus is far quicker than serial thought. If it weren't, you'd have been killed long ago. Well, to say automatic means self-moving, it doesn't mean anything else. But the speed at which it occurs far exceeds your thinking process. Self-preservation requires it. And spirit, who conducts that process through the soul, immediately, without the mediation of an external stimulus, as provided of the impulse, is aware that if this is allowed to operate, I have lost a vehicle. So it moves the vehicle. It isn't an individual act, is it? Because if you get 10,000 people all over the country and horns blowing at them simultaneously and they're all jumping out of the way, no single one of them could claim that it was an individual act. Could he? Because it's operating in all these people. That means the spirit, working through the world soul, trying to preserve its vehicles, whips them out of the way quickly. And then they find themselves on the curb and say, now how did I get here? That was lucky. And immediately afterwards, they are deserted by that same spirit, which says, now get on with your work and be more careful. If you belong to me, you're a vehicle. Now if people were very quick, they could immediately switch their attention back on that moment. Because really, it's a moment of an inbreak of spirit. And they could say, I wish I could do this all the time. and try and catch the feeling of that moment, and then they'll find they can reintroduce it deliberately. And then it becomes a basis of telepathy. Somebody's about to say something, and you deliberately supply to him the reply in his own mind before he opens his mouth. The result is he has second thoughts. That goes on much more often than people realise. Things can happen.
And if the shock was sufficiently great enough, would the length of time of the spirit inflow longer?
No. Once it's fulfilled its function, it immediately departs and leaves you with the body shaking with surprise. That one of the chief damages in a physical accident is shock. Not to the physical body, to the soul. Until we freely decide we'd like it all the time. The rest of the time we should be on our own so that we can find out whether we're really as clever as we think we are.
When a person gets a blow in the solar plexus, it can be very painful. Does that mean that some of that pain is in the soul? It's not all in the physical body.
All pain is in the soul. It isn't your physical body that feels, it's the soul that feels when you damage the physical body. It laments about the damage done to the body. You know that because if you make the pain go beyond a certain limit, you faint. The soul says, enough. And you don't know anything about it until you come round. You see, there's a limit. And over that limit, the soul says, I refuse to listen.
Could I interrupt here? Talking about this point of passing out at the moment of pain. Mm-hmm. We were discussing this the other day in relation to being given gas for a tooth.
Yes.
During that period, there's a state of fantasy, isn't there? Mm-hmm. How does the awareness act in that state? Can there be a state of... There can be a state of being conscious in that state, can't there? Although we refer to it as being unconscious.
Oh, to say it's unconscious is not to define the meaning of UN in unconscious.
No.
You are conscious of UN in unconsciousness. UN is half this lovely Egyptian word, UN, and U, which means a hair running backwards and forwards. Uno is Egyptian for a hair, and the hair is the symbol of the intuition and of fecundity of ideas, of fantasy. That's why there's a hair in the moon, and why the psychologist Jung came across this concept of the relation between a woman, a moon, and the hair, the intuition, the animal that leaps. And the hair is very, very canny and quite mad, isn't it? Hares have been known to waltz with foxes by mistake in March, and they're being hunted. Unconsciousness is the same thing as being hare-brained. There is all sorts of things that are happening all the time, and you haven't got a fixed reference point, so it's unconscious. But it doesn't mean what people think it means. It means unconscious. In the same way Jakob Böhme uses in the Signatura, he talks about the Ungrund, the origin of the world in the ground un. And it doesn't mean what people think it means.
Not negation.
Yes, it is. But negation means form.
I see, yes.
Continuous negation of form by another form, yes, yes, is fantasy. So the Ungrund, lovely sound, is the ground of the Uno, or harebrained activity. It's the same thing as hazy. But everything occurs to you all at once. Well, how can you separate it out? You're there as Aunt Maud going out with Uncle Bill, who died 25 years before she was born. Well, it can happen. Because eternally, they're always going out together. So the unconscious is a plenum of formal fantasies containing the whole potentiality of being. Has a fantastic actuality. And it's no good to you unless you can order it.
That's what I mean. There becomes a point where you can order it.
Yeah, well, that's the artistic process.
Yeah.
A fellow who wants to make a picture first has a fantasy, and then he selects out of the fantasy that which will serve his pictorial ends.
The person who's unconscious has no images or perceptions in his mind.
Oh, yes, he does. But those things are not serial, therefore his brain, which is a serial device, can't deal with them. So if he identifies with his brain, he cannot be unconscious. He's serially conscious. You see, the beauty of fantasy is it does all things. You know that what can happen to you, you can dream in 5 seconds a series of events which will take you 5 hours to describe. Have you ever had an experience where you've wakened in the morning, looked at the clock and say, I'll just give myself another 5 minutes, and you just dodge back a bit and then go to an interminable dream and say, oh my, oh, I should be up. And you open your eyes, look at the clock, and it's 3 minutes later than it was the first time. That's a very common experience. There's another level at which your thought processes are 30,000 times quicker than the ones you habitually use. That's quite a lot, isn't it? So that when you try to remember what has happened to you, in that un consciousness, the unu, the hair, is dashing about, getting all these forms, as quick as you can get out of the way of a bus when it comes, relative to your ordinary decision mechanism, problems are solved in fantasy, and if you could bring the solution back into serial thinking, you're the world's best inventor. Einstein, to do it, plays the fiddle. Not very well, but he plays the fiddle to keep his mind off science. And every now and then something goes, eek, and he says, ah. And he thinks, oh, let's write that down quickly before it goes. It's fantastic. And there's a theory. Practically, the whole of science is a history of two things. Exploded hypotheses or false guesses destroyed, and accidents, which are the cause of the chief big discoveries. Read the history of science. You'll find it's all based on those two things. One fellow knocking another fellow's guess down out of egotism. That can't be right because I didn't invent it, so I'll prove him wrong. And accident, like a fellow pouring acid on his cheese sandwich in a bad temper because he couldn't find plastic. They may tend to eat it and get a plastic sandwich. It's the origin of Kraft cheese.
Saying a man gets to that stage, Gene, where he is, can continually take from that fantasy, and he's suddenly knocked unconscious. That is, he's crossing the road and he's not warned in time, the bus goes faster.
He may not notice he's been hit.
I don't mean he's been killed, he's been knocked unconscious at this moment.
He may not notice.
I see. It doesn't become a fantastic state to him.
No, if you get used to that state called fantastic,
yeah.
That fantasia is imagination. It's the Greek for imagination. Now, the pharmum is Latin for temple, this thing. And it's the same thing as the time play, speeded up. The church, the temple, the holy place, holy because in fantasy are all things. The fan that a lady hides behind and coquettes with is the same root. It means to display simultaneously. You paint a pretty picture on the fan and you close it and you see the first picture. You open it one by one, that's serial time. You flash the whole thing, present it simultaneously, that's fantasy. Are you used to it? A man can be so used to it that somebody can come and pick his body up, this is happening, take him out and bath him and put him back again, you see, and he doesn't know he's had a bath.
Is this the cult of many colours again?
Yes. That fantastic world is the cult of many colours. A friend of mine who died on purpose so that his family would go out to work because they got used to depending on him, was frequently taken by his wife when she thought he needed a wash and washed while he was meditating and put back in his chair. It never bothered him at all. She was very fond of him.
Did they go out to work?
They had to, yes. On the Monday, he said to me, I'm going to die on Thursday. They'll have to go and work for themselves now. As long as I'm here, they won't pull their weight. So he went. Edison's grandfather did the same thing, and his father. Well, they lived long enough, and they said, I keep inventing things in a groove, you see, in the same field. So he told his daughter, I'm going upstairs now. Bye-bye. He went upstairs and died. His father had done the same thing. You don't have to wait to be knocked down. You can die on purpose. Japanese-trained soldiers did it when they were captured by the Americans. On the aircraft carriers. It's only a matter of concentration. Most people are too interested in what they might be missing to make this kind of sacrifice.
What a terrible thing, just when you've got to work, if you change your mind.
How can you change your mind if you know all? To know all is to be beyond changing your mind. You change your mind at levels other than that. Or, to be more accurate, your mind changes when a stimulus hits it.
Yes.
A man has his mind made up, as he says, and this is the final state, not having any more of that. And a stimulus goes, ping, and suddenly thinks, on second thoughts. Nothing to do with him. It's to do with the quality of the stimulus that hits him. Really, there's no freedom until you are whole. And the rest of the time, you're just moving towards it under an external stimulus, which is called grace. Otherwise, you wouldn't get there. The whole creation travaileth and groaneth to be delivered from vanity. That means that the moment that matter is made, which is a primary bondage, there's a continuous complaint in it, and an attempt to integrate and become big enough to understand how it got down there. That's the educational process in the universe. That's what we're here for. To use every situation to integrate our ideas and become so conscious of our own motives that we can assimilate everything that comes to us, no matter how fast it comes, not be disintegrated by it, and thereby gain immortality, that is, indestructibility. If you've got an idea that you don't like, which is somebody gives to you, makes you feel uncomfortable, you're not yet immortal. But if you don't care what anybody says, or does, or doesn't do, or say, then you're an immortal. On one occasion in the Chiang Tzu's friend, his wife died, and she was a very nice woman, so all his friends went round to express their profound sorrow, and when they got near the house, they could hear him playing the guitar and singing. So they went in and said, this is rather unseemly of you. Your dear wife has just died. And he said, yes. Well, where she has gone, she either exists or she doesn't. If she doesn't, there's nobody for me to worry about. I should be stupid to worry about what doesn't exist. On the other hand, if she still exists, why should I worry? She has survived. I also will go the same way, and if I exist, I will meet her. And if I don't, I will not be here to worry. And she will be stupid to worry about me. That's good logic, you see. But your emotive bias, which is partially hereditament and partially your training, makes you put false values on things. People, very, very often with children, you see some old card giving chocolate to a baby. Not for the baby's sake. The baby's already browned all over with chocolate. To get a little bit of emotive comeback. Because that emotive comeback is food for the emotional self. And some people live on the emotional gratitude of other beings. So they try to provoke them into expressions of gratitude so they can live. They're vampires. That's real vampirism. And you'd be surprised how much of your attitude towards people is conditioned by what was done on you when you were a child. We've all had something equivalent done on us. And yet until we break that and see the thing clearly, we're not yet immortal. Our ideas are false. We are eternal. And if we don't sort ourselves out, we'll be in an eternal mess. First of all, what is sanity? It's only Latin for whole, isn't it?
Otherwise, I'm not going to be too big or too little.
And just be whole. Don't be bitty. To be bitty, all you have to do is take any single idea or any partial idea, no matter how big the complex is, as long as it's finite, and assert that's the whole. It isn't. The whole is the thing the water goes down when you pull the plug out. You see, the soul is like a bath, if you like. If you pull the plug out of a bath with a lot of water in it, it starts twirling round, it makes rude noises, doesn't it? And it goes down, rudimentary noises, and it blows a trumpet, if you listen. That is the last trump. Because ultimately, when all the energy that's wound into the universe and makes the world so, has fulfilled its purpose, it then goes like this. And flings itself back again. And it's exactly the same process as water going down the hole in the bath. A trumpet instrument is made like this. Copied off that fact. Yes. When Joshua blew the trumpets and knocked the walls of Jericho down, he was only using a metaphysical truth that every particle of matter is made like that. So he said, all right, all the bricks there are made like this. So if I get an instrument shaped like this and blow down it, it should rattle them.
It should sound good on the stage.
If we can get one really sound idea, then it's strong enough, will we, other ideas we may have, will we sort them sold out?
Oh, yes. And you've got such an idea. The idea is the idea of truth. Truth is the Torah. Law, Torah, Rota. That everything goes round and everything contains everything in it. So that any single thing you care to look at is all things. You take an atom, what is it? It's a solar system in little. What is it that constrains the earth to go around the sun? The same force that constrains an electron to go round a proton. Isn't it? So, the whole solar system is in the atom, and the atom is in the solar system. There's a man in a rabbit, and a rabbit in a man. That runs through the whole of the religious teachings of the world. That man is a sort of synthetic structure of the mineral, the vegetable, and the animal world. He's a microcosm, a little universe. What is not in man is nowhere, and what is in man is everywhere.
And it is a feeling that comes with the idea. It's the feeling that counts, not the idea of forms, actually.
Well, you see, the word count means to set up ideas.
Yeah.
It is the feeling that sets the ideas up. So if you don't feel like counting, you don't set them up. So you get somebody that doesn't like counting and try to train them to recite their 15 and a half times table backwards, and they'll be very tardy at learning it. Because they don't feel like it. But there's a young fellow named Sawyer at Manchester University. He loves it. He feels like it. So he fabricates weird tables and learns them. I had a brother-in-law that used to be able to recite the alphabet backwards in 14 languages. But he couldn't recite it the right way. Because he deliberately, to avoid mistakes, wrote them all out backwards and said them over and over again. And he found that if he remembered them the right way, he sometimes got it wrong backwards. So he practiced like mad until he could say them backwards, but he couldn't say them forward.
Did he have any friends?
Not many, because he used to start this. He used to start it, you see. As soon as there was a party, he said, you know what I can do? You can make virtue out of anything, can't you?
This would suggest then that as long as you had a certain number of right ideas, that in the process of the second death, the wrong ideas would fall away anyway.
They'll be flung off.
They would be flung off.
And they'll go in a curve and then come back in their right place.
Yeah.
Look at the idea of the true, the good and the beautiful that Plato talks about. They're said to be three in one, and yet you mustn't confound them. The good is deeper than the beautiful. That's a funny statement.
Hmm.
Why? Because the beautiful is what you can see. It is form as seen. The true is form as rotated. The beautiful is form as seen, giving rise to a feeling in you.
Hmm.
The feeling arising from seeing form, the form being true, is called beauty. But behind both truth and beauty is the good. And good is good manx, if you take the D off it. So there's gu and g. You know, the Gospel of John is translated as gu and g, instead of God and the Word. Gu is the same as gullet. Gullet is will. Behind the beauty and truth, there is will, which is the good. Gu-da means the will to divide. The will to divide is creative at the D end of the word. At the gu end, it's drive. This is why it is said that the good is more fundamental than either beauty or truth. Didn't Keats say truth is beauty and beauty truth? That's all you need now. Well, he was selecting poetically from that. And at the back of it was good, the unmentionable, because good is fundamental drive. Without that fundamental drive, there would be no form. Without form, you couldn't feel form. And if the form didn't establish itself as a rota, there would be no truth. Truth is established form, and established form is rotating form. And the feeling that you get from this form is beauty. It's a very smooth feeling. Notice in the word beauty itself, which is French extraction, the French word for water, isn't it? E-A-U, in the word. And that means this undulation, this swelling and falling, smoothly, without jarring, without jolting. So we can say the uninterrupted motion of the will as feeling is called beauty. And the established form of the will is called truth. Then you could see why it is said that good is fundamental, and yet somehow goodness, beauty and truth are a trinity, and you mustn't confuse them. In the same way in Christianity we say there is God the Father, the Son and the Ghost. And the Father is not the Son is not the Ghost is not the Father, but they are all God. And the Father is prior to the Son, not in time, but ontologically, that is in being. And the Ghost proceeds equally out of the Son and out of the Father. The Father is the generative energy mobilizes itself and becomes the Son, the Logos, or reason behind the universe. And out of the Father, or energy, and the Logos, or reason, emerges the operation called the Spirit. And the three are not to be separated, because there is no operation other than energy logically doing something. And yet you mustn't confuse them, because the operation can be intellectually separated from the form of it and from the energy which is in that form. In China, where they don't like the concept of God very much, they use the trinity heaven, earth and man, where earth represents the substance, heaven the force, the action of the force onto the substance produces man between. So man is a mediator between force and matter. His body is the matter and his will is the force. So the will belongs to heaven, the body belongs to earth. Fundamentally the same idea. Just a different frame of reference.
Did you say something about the link between the ancestors and those chemical gradients you were talking about?
Yes. Remember that the feeling is field consciousness. If you feel what you are, close your eyes, relax all your muscles, and try to feel what you are. If you're perfectly relaxed, you will not feel that you have any form. You will just feel that you are. You will not be able to find your edge. If you're very, very sensitive and start feeling for your edge, you can't find it. If you're relaxed. In order to get the feeling that you exist, you must contract a bit. This feeling, when it mobilizes itself, is called will. And the way in which it mobilizes itself is the creating process which produces chemicals. And your feeling behaves in various ways. And each way that the feeling behaves has a chemical precipitate as its result. That means there is a definite chemical for every emotion you've got. This means that if your ancestors have felt in a certain way during the period of feeling such and such feelings, they have made their chemical precipitates in their body of a certain order, exactly like their feelings, only in the gross world. Those chemicals are then modifying the sperms in the male, the ova in the woman, and therefore biasing chemically the body to respond to certain stimuli of the physical world. So that all our hereditament derived from our ancestors feeling they would like to do certain things, and the feelings producing the chemicals producing the sex cells, and the sex cells being the starting point for a new body, which is already chemically biased. Which is why Gandhi said of his first son, who doesn't believe anything he said and doesn't like him, "When I remember my condition when he was conceived, I'm not surprised." I don't agree with me either, because it inverted all he believed. That was only natural. He held no grievance against the son, because he knew the son was the spontaneous precipitate of his then condition. And if he met himself again in that condition, most certainly he would disagree. And he was meeting himself, namely in his son. Which means that you can actually control the temperament of a child that you would give birth to by deliberately controlling your feelings. You can define what kind of a child you would like in feeling, an idea. In general, in a man and a woman, the woman should take care of the purity of the feeling, the man should take care of the logic, and then the two of them producing a child, the child will have the right feeling and the right reason. In the Old Testament, when it says the sons of God were thinking about truth, and the daughters of men, who were being willfully naughty, married together and produced the Nephilim, the horrible titans, because they were as knowledgeable as their fathers and as naughty in the will as their mothers. But it gives you a real possibility of controlling progeny as your own biological chemical precipitates. It also gives you a very quick way of transforming your own chemistry. Not by swallowing tablets from outside, but by attending to your feeling. Cultivate that feeling that feels the whole universe.
Would you feel it necessary to have children if you'd arrived at that state? Biological children?
Necessary. What does necessary mean there? A movement of your essence. To differentiate yourself. In that sense, you would feel that it would be a good thing.
Yes.
That's why when that idea is clearly seen, that often arises in a man that's, sometimes he may be quite old, and when he's introduced to that idea, it becomes a bit clear. He thinks, good gracious, if I'd have known then what I know now, I could have precipitated a different set to the ones I actually got. You see, and then there arises in him a positivity towards life, and he can start generating again if you don't stop him. Like Goethe did, you see. When Goethe was 74, he got a new idea and thought, good gracious. And he looked round for a little bit of substance, and there was a 16-year-old substance there, and he promptly proposed to him. Thereupon the parents and everybody jumped on him and said, you dirty old man. But he wasn't. He'd got a new idea. And he was going to give it to the world. And they stopped him.
It wasn't necessary.
There was a higher necessity there. That child would have been born what you call old-fashioned.
That connect in any way with the story of Joseph?
Yes.
Connects in all ways with the story of the youngest child, doesn't it, really?
Well, you know, in the fairy stories, the younger child is cleverer than the other children because the parents are more balanced and integrated. You should wait until you're about 120, really, for the other person. Usually, industrial revolution has made you too tired. But then there'd be no problem, would there? All the children would be automatically obedient. They'd see the wisdom of their parents.
What do you think of that?
It's the golden age. There'd be none of that true friendship called opposition. Yes,
good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night.
Good
night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night.
Well, obviously, you couldn't look for a specific experience before you had it. You couldn't expect a blind man, for instance, to look for colours until he can see. These things happen spontaneously, or they don't happen. If you say, what kind of an experience, you can start, supposing we said, well, it's such an experience, and describe it. You record on your brain that, then you proceed to work on it to lift it to the level of hallucination. Then you say you had an experience. A lot of the experiences of the pseudo-saints of that order, they know what they're looking for and then they precipitate it. One man is looking for the stigmata, so he makes them. It's not a proof that he shared in the passion of Christ. It could easily be a proof that he had a wonderful power of concentrating on what it felt like to have nails in there. Because we can induce those symptoms under hypnosis without using a spiritual man.
I was thinking of the story in the book of Ouspensky when he returned from America being looking old and ill and telling his disciples that they must go back to the beginning, that he was going to abandon the system. But apparently some of them thought that it meant that at a certain stage you went beyond systems. But when I read that, it seemed to me that Spencer would have disintegrated himself if that were the case. No. It struck me as though he were disillusioned, but some clung to that idea.
Well, they had to, because they almost wanted to believe that Spencer could give them something that they didn't have to work for. They were pursuing power, Spencer was. But Spencer is a thinker, so he makes systems. Gurdjieff told him from the beginning, it isn't a system. Gurdjieff said, what I am telling you isn't a system, it's little bits. Don't make it into a system. Ouspensky is a system maker, so he made a system. And he tried, and he discovered he'd circumscribed himself with his own definitions. He was in the dark circle of definition. The dark circle that the mystics discover when they define very cleanly, they've got to give it up. Ultimately, you have to jump outside the circle that you've defined, and it's a leap in the dark because you've not yet been out of it. Uspensky was driven to that by fact. He discovered that he couldn't produce phenomena. Gurdjieff could. And Uspensky couldn't. And he was lecturing about things he knew nothing about. In the new model of the universe, he had talked about things which, if he had understood them, he would have been quiet. But he picked them up out of books and wrote them down and made a fat one out of it. But he didn't understand the fundamental principle of any of it. And so he was a genuinely disillusioned man. But he was also a man that knew he was nearing death. And he didn't want to go into the never-never land with on his mind that he had foisted an erroneous system on innumerable people. That's true. Because Gurdjieff had warned him, you will have to go to purgatory if you tell lies. Gurdjieff was always frightening people like that. You know, all and everything, he describes a wonderful purgatory, doesn't he? It's so painful, that place, that the Lord comes down periodically to let you know that he exists, because it's really so awful if he doesn't.
I wonder if I can try to make clear what's in my mind. There are all those people following Uspensky. They're working hard, they're sincere, they're trying. And they're wrong.
Well, you see, now you've assumed that they're sincere without defining what sincerity is. What does it mean? What does it mean to be sincere? Sin means separation. And the ser, or care, means hard. You can't be sincere unless you are hard with yourself and separate out what is rubbish and throw it away. Now, how many fellows of Uspensky do you know who are sincere? I know a lot of them, but I don't know one sincere one.
It would follow that all the people who accepted his teaching would lose their immortality in the effort to try and gain it.
They're not looking for immortality. Not those people. They have another idea behind it, power. As a matter of fact, the son of a man who's in control of quite a large place recently refused to advertise Bennett's next campaign because of the open declaration of many, many followers of Bennett who claims to be teaching what Uspensky taught, who claim to be teaching what Gurdjieff taught, and yet they're always talking about the acquisition of power. The whole thing is misconceived. An individual can't have power. The power is always in the same hands. The absolute's got it. You won't relinquish it into an individual. That would be stupid and metaphysically impossible. It is the function of the being to become conscious of what is form, that's the individual, to see form as circumscription and to abandon form because it is circumscribed and therefore limited, and to climb above the level where he insists on defining himself as an individual. And then he's not pursuing power as an individual, but he will find power, but not as an individual. When Christ says, seek first the kingdom of heaven and all these little things will be added to you, he says, don't try and be an individual, first try and be super-individual. The super-individual is power, the absolute. First be that, never mind about your private purposes. First be absolute, and then you'll find that the individual is still inside you. And then you can move it. But not the other way around. You can't take little Johnny Smith and blow him up to cosmic size, and then let him come down again, still that big, and say to Johnny Stout, yeah, I did better than you did in the exams. And yet they're as naive as that. They don't know the meaning of any of the terms. Gurdjieff told them there was a language without which you cannot think. But he never told them what it was. Uspensky was biting all the time for that, and he never got it. Because he wanted it. And want is deficiency, and it isn't given to the deficient. Deficient is defacere, dividing off. affirm for the whole all the time. Never mind the individuality. Say, if I've got anything any good, anybody can have it. Christ says some terribly hard things. He's a sincere man. He's a without man. He throws things away, and he's a hard man. He insists on doing it. That's what sincere means. He can do without, and he's hard. He's not a slushy Italian Christ. He's Christ. He's a very hard man. That kra means hard. And he lets something out. That's Jesus. Jesus means free. Christ means this hard ball, this circular bound being. He says, be hard like this and be free simultaneously. Don't try to get something for yourself, excluding other beings. It isn't logical. Whatever you get for yourself, if it's any good and you want to sell it, it will have to suit other people. So really, a big businessman like Henry Ford can only sell Fords if people want them. In effect, he has been crucified on Ford manufacturing for the sake of the man in the street. That's true, isn't it? Unless you've got a good commodity, you can't sell it. If you are selling it, it's only for the customers. So you're a slave. See the logic of that and then say, I affirm whatever I've got, anybody can have. And mean it. Christ says it in the way, if a man takes your overcoat, give him your jacket as well. That'll make him think. If he takes that, take your shirt off. If he takes that, take your trousers off. If a policeman comes along, that man is responsible. It's having the nerve to do that, you see, to see the inherent logic of it. Most people can't see the logic inside a parabolic statement. All the great teachers are parabolic. They say a series of curved wills, of wills that go beyond the situation. Parabolic means beyond this ball. Go outside the circumscribed and assert a pair of opposites. Tao Te King says the pine tip needle and the mountain are the same size. Stupid European mind says that means relatively. To a microbe, sitting on the pine tip, it may be like a mountain, you see, and to a large giant, a mountain may be like a pine tip. Nothing to do with it. It is a statement that at infinity, the mountain and the pine tip are the same size. They really are. I don't think I've got a piece of paper big enough that I can prove it to you geometrically. I'll show you just a little bit of it, and you can see. You got a bit more paper. In the process of creation at the moment, because I'm starting in the centre, and we know that infinity is away from this centre, don't we? And we see that without altering the pitch of these compasses, we are making a triad inside. And there's our initial triad, which represents the Trinity. Each one of those is a little impulse centre. We're constructing it backwards from our end, the finite end. So there's a ripple starting from here and spreading out. That's one of them. This is full of them, but these compasses are too big to draw them. That's the centre, that's the centre. So if I take this one, right over to that one, that's about it. And ripples starting from the centre where I've put those compasses will be hitting there and hitting the other two, won't it? You see that? Now, I've observed that's obviously a triangle with a very deep indentation there, isn't it? I use this other centre here and do the same. I'm now drawing you what is called the rose in the rosy cross. You'll see it in a moment. This cuts those two. Now, you notice in this second case, but the dip here is slightly less than this one, isn't it? And as we're going away, it must become bigger. Before we go any farther, can you see a lion's face in there? I'll just shade it for you. There's the mouth. There's its chin.
Yeah.
There's its nose.
Yeah.
There's its forehead. And this is the mane. You see that? Yeah. That's the Lion of Judah. Actually, that is the basis of the geometry of a lion's face. And why the lion is what it is based on that geometry. If I were to construct this with smaller compasses, I can draw you the exact geometry of a lion's face using nothing except the compasses and nothing arbitrary. That's the Lion of Judah looking at you there. Again, we go right through. Extend the compass up to there. And ripples now pass this far. See? Here's the next center. There's the next. Now again, this indentation is a bit smaller, isn't it? And it must keep on getting smaller, mustn't it? All the time. All those ripples are interfering. Now you see, this structure is becoming rounder, isn't it? As a matter of fact, very soon it will look like a perfect circle. I'm taking this straight through there to find that place. As far as we can go, I think. Now you can see what's happening there. This is becoming more and more and more approximate to a perfect circle, isn't it? We've constructed this from the inside, the finite end, our end, as creatures. But really, it is a precipitate from infinity, from one circle. And that one circle just vibrates from three points, like this. And the result is the precipitation of a trinity in its centre. So that means to say, if we take this circle and say that is the Son, and this circle and that is the Father, and this circle and that is the Ghost, and then we look for them over here, at infinity they're exactly coincident, aren't they? So if we say this one is a mountain, and this one is a pine tip, this is the end of a bruiser's nose, and lift them to infinity, again, they're identical. And infinity is the origin of all these. So every difference at the centre is an identity at infinity. That's why the difference is in us. That may be you, that's Ken, and that's me. At infinity, we're identical. At this end, we are different. But we're only different at this end. And our difference presupposes an identity at infinity. Because we can't have a difference except of a substance which is identical. Because nothing can produce a difference except sameness. Because difference couldn't do it. If you had some irreducible different things, they could never change. So the idea of change is grounded in the idea of the changeless, which is at infinity. Now you can see all the church window designs are in there. Can you see them?
Yeah.
You know the great Gothic initiates who designed the cathedrals? This is their design. You know, suddenly, from nowhere, without any previous training, with no historic precedence at all, suddenly some unknown architects came from no one knows where, and constructed the great Gothic cathedrals. Infinity.
Yeah. Would you mind repeating the little bit about the sameness agency.
Well, let's take this. You see, we call this a wave. It's a difference. If we hadn't got the continuum of water, which is sameness, we couldn't make the difference of the waves. We can't have those differences without this sameness. Supposing we said, let's cut that off, put it up there, cut that off, put it up there, cut that off, put it up there, put that up, cut it up there. We now have four discrete, that is separated, grown apart, and different things. Change is impossible. If those are eternal, well, then each one is itself, become and become itself. So unless we have something the same, we can't really have a legitimate difference. Those differences could not change. So unless there is a substance, a soul, underneath a baby, it could never change and become a man. There's the sameness, the substance of the soul there, which allows these vibrations, differentiations, at different time intervals.
Yes, I see.
So we say then that change presupposes a background of the changeless. The mere fact that the Earth can go round the Sun and keep it in orbit means that there is a sameness of gradient in the field of the solar system. Otherwise it would wander. Einstein says space-time is curved, you see, and that's why the planets keep in their curved orbits. He said there's a sameness there. His name is Einstein, one stone. He produces a theory called unifield. Again, he's intuiting his own structure. And this diagram is tremendously important because it releases you from all sorts of things, you see. You might say this is, we'll say that's the Arab people, and this is Oriental communism, and this is Occidental theism, if you like. Well, are you going to take sides and fight one of those against the others when you know that at infinity they're all precipitants of identity? On whose side should you fight? And everybody's got Gothmituns on their helmets. So everybody says God is on their side. It is true. They're not telling lies. He backs all the horses in case one doesn't run.
That's an interesting diagram. I've never seen that before.
Well, you see, everything is contained in that because at infinity, the ripples that run through here will produce.
Well, I've never seen it. I've never seen it this way. I've seen it designed in windows.
Yes, well, this is the origin of it. Yes. This is going on. These straight lines, which I'm using a ruler for, I wouldn't need a ruler for if I had a very big pair of compasses, because these straight lines are curved, struck from infinity. You see what's happening? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That's axis theory. The wheel. So, if we go to the first limit, you see, we can always find 6, can't we? There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We go out, we'll say, there's the limit of a being, up to there. And there's the limit of the next. There are the next, there are the next, and so on. Because these are not arbitrary, they're just curves struck from infinity. An infinite curve is defined as one struck from infinity. An infinity being no finite, an infinite curve is a straight line.
Yeah.
So we call a straight line a special curve, special case of a curve, namely one struck from infinity. Again, that's the identity of opposites. Is that straight? Einstein says, no, it's curved. Some people say it's manifestly straight. I did it with a ruler. Well, that ruler's infinitely curved. that is not finitely curved. You can't measure it because it's not finite. If it were a finite curve, you could measure it. To call it an infinite curve is as much sense as to say that a curve itself is a case of an infinitely straight line. Because an infinitely straight line comes back on itself.
So a straight line really doesn't exist.
Now that, again, is not a dialectical statement. That is a dianoic statement. That's a statement made in the soul, not in the spirit. Existere means this wheel. That exists, that exists, that exists. This exists, this exists. Everything is existent. If it is, it exists. Whatever it is. It means that straight and curved are identical terms at infinity. Love and hate are identical at infinity. Do you know what makes those two keep apart? According to Empedocles, hate. Do you know what makes them all keep together? Love. Hate is hate, which means spirit crucified. What is spirit? God is the spirit, and God is love. Hate is love. Freedom is bondage. That's a dialectical statement. You see, the realm of spirit asserts always a pair of opposites. And the realm of the soul, in discursive reason, takes one of a pair of opposites and throws the other one away and thinks it's got truth. But you can't have truth unless you have opposition. Because the meaning of the word opposite is that. There's your circle, there's your diameter, and that is opposite that. There's the ob.
Yeah.
And that's the or, and that posit one there, posit one there. There's the ob, and that is opposite. And they both exist. You must assert it. Somebody says, you are very kind. You say, yes, I hate you. They may not know what you're talking about. They say, he's a queer fellow. They get hold of your feeling, which contains these two ideas, if you really see it. And they think you've got a funny sense of humour. And you have, because HM... H is spirit, and M is matter. And matter is only a behaviour of spirit, and spirit is only matter hurrying up. So in English, if we're very materialistic, we say, is it important? Does it matter? How often do we hear people say, does it spirit? Our tendency is into matter.
Yeah.
That's not important, it doesn't spirit. Let's start a new usage of language. Let's float, does it spirit equals, is it important? All you have to do is just go up, bong, and say it to a few people, and in no time it'll be on the air. In a variety program.
Yes, it would.
Who's going to throw the pebble? We used to supply Tommy Handler with all his programs. We knew a lot of the people in the BBC that were handling that programme, and we used to write the jokes for them. And then we'd say, now we'll see how long it takes to get this one on the air. And just throw in a little idea like that. It never took more than a fortnight. Usually it was the same week. Because it releases you, you see. To be really in jail is to think that a half-truth is a whole truth. The truth is the whole circle. The Chinese say you can't get rid of the other end of the stick. There's a stick and there's a knife. Knife into stick, end gun off, put it over there. There's another one, put knife there. Another one, knife. You come down to such a minute bit that the blade of the knife is too thick to cut it. And it's still got two ends.
Well, using the word infinity, when you say those all become the same as infinity, how do we relate to that, the expression infinitely small?
Well, it's just the same. If I can travel away from that centre infinitely, the distance that way and this way must be the same, mustn't it?
Yeah.
So I can shovel infinitely back. Well, coming in towards the centre infinitely is a small.
Yes.
And the rabbis say humorously, they say infinity both ends. Because if we start at the earth and go out infinitely, there must be an infinite distance. Well, come back, it's the same distance going as coming.
The only thing is, you would never get there, would you?
Where?
To infinity.
You see, it's a dialectical thing. You have to seize the significance by squeezing two ideas together in your mind.
But infinity hasn't got a size, has it?
Well, how can you say infinitely large and infinitely small? When St. Paul says, when we see him face to face, we shall comprehend the length and breadth and depth of love, this is what he's talking about. And there's three lines there through those centres, and I get six sides. A cube has got six faces, hasn't it?
Yes.
There's one, two, three, four, five, six. It's the form of the cross, isn't it?
Yes.
If we wish to make a cube, we first make a cross like that. So, when we place the Christ on that cross, and we write the title on there, I-N-R-I, which doesn't mean what it's supposed to mean, we've really drawn the picture of the 3D man, haven't we? The gross physical man.
Yes.
Because if we fold him up, he's a box man. So we said the cross, really. And the original drawings of that cross show those six parts on them. They knew what they were doing. They took a cube, they opened it and crucified the figure on it. They didn't leave it closed because they said people will know about that. They'll guess that we mean their physical bodies. And the title for A Man So Crucified is I, Dio, God, Crucified. The idiot. The idiot who knows it, he doesn't mind saying to somebody who says, you're very kind, yes, I hate you. Because it always releases the mind. People are in the groove all day, say nice things or nasty things about the weather. So if it's a bright day today, and you look at it and say, yes, somebody's been polishing it. What you do is lift it out of the groove and put it in another groove. It releases them. That's the meaning of the keys of binding and loosing. If you understand dialectics, you can either confirm a person in an error. If he's terribly arrogant, you leave him with him. If he's not, you lift it out and put it in another place. And you can do either, if you understand that dialectical principle. When Plato said that dialectic is the king of sciences, he meant it. All other sciences are particular. Take all the sciences there and put them all together. In a big ball, call it science, philosophic sphere, wisdom. And when you've done it, say yes, that's circumscription. Beyond it, there is what? Infinity, where all differences to different sciences. You see, let's take the science of religion, the science of philosophy, the science only with C essence, the essence of what you've seen. So we have, say, physical science, philosophical science, religious science. As infinity, they're all one. Here we separate them out. For convenience. Or for dialectical exercise. But we must crush them all together.
That is related to the serialness, isn't it?
Of course. It's here the serialness appears, not there. And notice that if you go through any one of these points and bisect the angle between the other two, see what happens. You're always bisecting this process, see? So suppose we say physical science and religious science and philosophical science, we bisect religion and philosophy to keep on the scientific track. The scientific tract goes between and never goes to either. The philosophic tract goes between religion and science. The religious one goes between philosophy and science. That's definition. If we do that carefully, we'll come to the six systems we did once. There's six points of view. There's three points of view, and each one of the three is right and wrong. That is, we can posit it or negate it. We should almost teach ourselves to move out. Now, you can see here that the distance from here to here is diminishing, isn't it? See, that angle is getting flatter, isn't it? So that's narrower than this one. So you can see a very peculiar thing, that the high frequencies are over there. In that diagram, aren't they? Which is very strange. Which means that your physical body is the lowest frequency there is. If you draw along here, you can see it in this, can't you?
Yes, if that diagram is extended, they become very, very close.
Well, at infinity, they overlap.
Yes.
And infinity does not exist. Because exists means a real. Infinity is on the other side of it. Forever. That's a drawing of Ezekiel's wheel in the vision of Ezekiel. Now imagine that, that's only a plain drawing. Draw it in 3D. Mentally.
Become a very involved thing in 3D, because those three circles in that plane, the centre three circles,
you should have another one here.
Yes.
A fourth. That's the hidden one. That's why the word first and fourth are identical. They're both from the same root, and they both mean fire. The original. If you get four billiard balls and put them together, they will fit like that, and the fourth here. And you then extend this diagram through the lot and show all the relations. And that's a diagram of the frequency structure of the universe. You can see then how people who are apparently separate there can be captured. Supposing this man is a scientist and he hates religion and philosophy. So you bisect him like this very carefully without using a religious or a philosophic definition. You see, you start taking through here like this, scientific definitions. You want to get them to infinity first, and then bring them back again like this. And you won't notice over there what you've done. That would be tremendously clear to find out what you've done over there, because you've done nothing, it's infinity.
Abel, are you going to get your bus?
Yes.
The primary colours in the light spectrum are precipitated that way.
Yes.
And the rest are caused by overlapping. Thus the colour there is pure, that's pure, that's pure, and there you get the resultant of the two, and in that centre you get the three colours together, which is black.
Mm.
And if you deal with that at a certain frequency, it's white.
That again becomes the diagram Mr. Atwood gave us some time ago. The observer is not the observed diagram.
Mm.
If the centre becomes black.
It becomes the absorption point, doesn't it then?
Mm. That's the pupil.
Mm.
In the real sense, you can take that as the pupil, this part as the iris, and the rest of it is the ball. And if you go to infinity, when you get there, it's a perfect circle, and if you go farther than that, that's spirit. And you can almost go farther than that when you get to infinity. for there's no circumscription. You see, my Socrates said that the dialectical process lifts you above all error.
How would you place a man upon that? I asked it, I was thinking about that technique we were once talking about, a diagnosis from the iris of a man's eye, where seeing certain formations in the iris, you were saying that you could diagnose a particular part of the body.
Mm.
So I take it that you could actually place a man physically upon that field, wouldn't you?
Do you remember the diagram we did about the devil?
Yes.
Well, you can see that this part would have been the devil, wouldn't it? Can you?
Yes.
Right.
The one we didn't use, yes.
The one we didn't use. That one.
Yes.
That one would be the one that would cut through there.
Yes.
And spoil that triangle, wouldn't it?
Yes.
If we constructed it there, we would shift the whole stress off that triangle, wouldn't we? That one is your brain.
I see.
That's your sexual generative centre. And these are the lung centres. And there's your spinal axis. Mm-hmm. So there's the cross, look. That's your ordinary cross through there.
Yeah.
Now, legs and arms are extensions. Arms are this side, legs down below, and your thinker is down there. That makes the intellect into the devil.
Hello, Dave.
Hello.
Now, if you look in the iris, you'll find that on the mental. If you look in the iris on that point, suppose we use this as a centre where these two intersect and draw a little circle in here. Mm-hmm. You'll find that corresponds with your feet, which is pudendum.
Mm-hmm.
And the other end is your brain. And the things that are recorded in the iris there are to do with the mental aspects. If you get a damage on your feet, factually and euphemistically, it shows down there. And if in the brain centre corresponding, it shows up there. And damage of the lungs shows in those opposite points. And the spine goes down there on one eye, and on the other side on the other. Across there. And the rib marks can be seen like that.
They can be seen in those little
Striations,
yeah. Now, those striations, I remember you once saying, showed integration when they all fell into the centre in an equilibrium. I take it that any movement away from equilibrium will just throw them out.
It distorts them, yes.
They can distort them momentarily.
Oh, yes, you can see them move, actually.
And then fall back in again.
You let somebody look in your eye very, very carefully with the magnifying glass while you tell them something and you see little tremors.
I see. Are
they concentric, those spies? Are they concentric?
If we draw it, you've got the opening, which, of course, is nothing at all, the pupil. Which is the lens, isn't it? Then you have the iris, and all the striations are radially pointing like that, all the way round. And this is the ball of the eye. That north point is up there, and you'll find certain mental things around there. And your feet and genitalia are just there and there. And your feet, knees, and thighs, and your gullet is around there. But the mental aspect of the gullet is up there, and the lower part of it is there. And your ribs are across there, broken ribs show across there, and your spine is there on one, and then there on the other. In other words, it's exactly that diagram.
Yes.
So it's really a little universe.
Just get hold of that idea then. If you say had a tendency to stammer, you'd find it just at the top end of the place of that.
Well, you'd find some sort of evidence of it about there, wouldn't you? There's your spinal line. And the subject that you were stammering about would also show a distortion. It'd usually be diametrically opposite to it down there. You can often find where there is a damage like that, a distortion on the opposite side. Because you know a distorted mind produces a distortion there, or is the result of one. It follows logically, you see. If all these are identical at infinity, then all the opposites are identical. They must therefore bear a very, very close frequency relationship to each other. That means everything is the opposite of what it seems to be. That's why so often if somebody is ill, it's because they've been well, too well, in the opposite direction.
Around the Irish, have a black line, and inside that, I've noticed a kind of two faint circles. What are those?
You mean on the Irish edge here?
Yes.
Well, they correspond with your skin. It's binding the whole thing. You see, the white of the eye is the whole universe. The striations of the eye are the forces. The white of the eye is all colours balanced. The iris is all colours split, striated. And the pupil is black, which is white inverted. So the iris represents the universe of forms which are mediating the individuated soul, here dark, and the world soul. The world soul sends forms into the individual soul. The individual soul reacts upon it. And the relation between the individual and the world soul shows in this striation. The general attitude in the colour, particular attitudes, in the precipitation of chemicals at particular points. That's if you eat a lot of iodine, it'll make your eyes tawny. You should think about the iris as if it's doing that at you, and if the nerves from all over the body are going like that and pointing their ends out of the iris. So you can see the chemicals in the end of it, which are feeding precipitates. The product of the relation between the individual and the world soul.
And what about the eye itself? An eye, for example, which is not working correctly, an eye which refuses to see or casts itself to one side.
Person?
Yes, I mean the physical eye itself.
Well, the physical eye, well, that will be obeying the soul. As an outward glide,
yeah,
is a sign of escapism. They refuse to focus in that. They turn away from the subject and the eye fails. In other words, a fear of a squint. But the thing is that they can't dodge it.
Mm.
And they just bring the eye close together and don't see it.
Yes.
So what, in general, the squint is fear and the glide is escapism.
Yeah.
Which are both the same at infinity, aren't they?
Yeah.
You escape from what you don't like.
Yeah.
If you can't escape, you're afraid of it and you contract.
Yes.
Will you excuse us?
Yes.
Thank you very much, sir.
Bye-bye.
What you wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden the whole thing went just the other way and you didn't seem to be part of it and yet you were able to carry it out with ease. What happened in a case like that?
Well, you've moved out. You see, there's your problem. There's a person and there's the alternatives. There's a person, there's a pair of alternatives, there's a person, there's a pair of alternatives. If you're in the centre, it's problematic. Sometimes you get working on it so much, you spin round and round and round, and you can't solve it, and the mind goes very quickly and changes its phase, because it's gone too fast, and it flings you out into this circle. Then you can see that that's not a problem. And the thing that you identified with before, which you thought was your individuality, is seen there somehow, and yet the problem seems to be being solved from outside. It is, because you've been flung out. If you work hard enough, you can get flung out to there. The problem is only being too near something. We'll have to dash, Ken. We've got to go only tonight.
Do you want to stay home from supper?
Yes, sir. How are you?